Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Dearing. So glad you are starting the week with us here on a Monday, which means Mondays with Boston Mayor Michelle Wu. And as I will often say to you, this is live radio, folks. And sometimes we deal with the ups and downs of what happens when that's the case. And that's the case now. Boston Mayor Michelle Wu, on her way here, will be joining us momentarily. So let me tell you a little bit about what you've said you want to talk about today. And it is not surprising that it's very similar to what you told us you wanted to talk about with Massachusetts Governor Maura Healey when she was on the show last week. You have the tea on your minds. We know that Michelle Wu rides the tea. The question is, how is she experiencing it now? What is her reaction to the announcement today from Massachusetts Governor Maura Healey that there is a new general manager of the MBTA? Mayor Wu came this morning from the announcement from the Boston Athletic Association that the Boston Marathon has a new sponsor in Bank of America. So listen, that is a pretty big deal. One, because John Hancock, for decades, was the sponsor of the Boston Marathon, and it was a tight brand that got us all the way through, including 10 years ago with the Boston Marathon bombing. To have a new sponsor now both means changes in the marathon, but also shows the significance potentially of the corporate commitment of Boston, of Bank of America, to the city of Boston. Boston Mayor Michelle Wu is actually, you can hear her, there goes the door opens, she comes to the chair, she sits down, puts the headphones on, puts her microphone, now I'm coaching the mayor on the air about how to make sure the sound is solid. Good morning, Mayor. There's a glass of water for you there. I was just updating our listeners on what we're going to be talking to you about.
Great.
So I'm assuming you broke no traffic laws on your way over here today.
We were right up at the edge.
Right up at the edge. All right. So listen, I do want to jump right in, right? We have two pieces of news I want to discuss with you. Since I was just talking about the Boston Marathon, you were, in fact, this morning at the Boston Athletic Association's announcement of Bank of America as the new sponsor. Why did you want to be there and tell us what's important about that announcement?
This event is maybe the one time a year where everyone in the city can say, we are ready. We know what date it is that the whole world is going to turn its eyes to Boston. And we're welcoming of that, the world's greatest race, that sense of the resilience of the human spirit and how much it means when people can come together and cheer each other on. I have a little bit of a taste of this from many, many years ago. When I was in college, my roommate, who is far more athletic than I am, was running for charity in the marathon. And so we all had kind of took turns. We were going to run different legs with her. And so I was assigned to the last leg just to kind of help her keep pace and finish. And back then, the rules were much more lax before
less
2013.
Yeah.
And you could just kind of hop in and run alongside someone. What I didn't know is that at a certain point, the barriers from that point onto the finish line go up solid, and then you can't get out of the race if you haven't exited then. So I'm at the end. My roommate has now seen the finish line. She just takes off, right? Has a burst of energy. I'm left there, can't escape. So I was like, okay, I'm just going to walk now. I don't need to finish this. And then the spectators are all saying, come on, you can do it. It's the end, right? The sense of camaraderie and love for cheering someone on who you have no idea who they are, what their story is, but that feeling is palpable along the entire route.
So
people are in it for each other.
Did you run? Did you finish running?
I did. I was like, okay, I'm going to
And was it exhausting at the end? Were you still like...
I only did a little over a mile of it, but it felt very... I felt very accomplished after that. So anyway, this has been an event that the Boston Athletic Association puts on with a significant sponsorship and partnership from a major partner. And that has been John Hancock for many years. They've been an incredible partner for over three decades, and they recently unwound that. And so Bank of America is a really natural fit to step in, and they're committed to making this about more than a marathon. Year-round contributions to the city, plugging in to make sure that sense of seeing yourself reflected and connected to the sport and passion and recreation of running is something we'll see and feel across all of our neighborhoods.
Last time you were here, we talked about One Boston Day and your call to service to people both in Boston and who from the greater Boston area as we observe the 10th anniversary isn't the right word, 10 years since the Boston Marathon.
That's right.
The marathon is coming up. So the question today is, any other special arrangements, security, et cetera, that you're doing for the marathon itself on Patriots Day?
Every year, a very intense amount of preparation and logistical planning around public safety and coordination goes into this. It's really one of the events that is on the list of national law enforcement agencies' sort of largest sporting events that bring people in from all over the world. And so there's a very carefully coordinated series of months of planning. I've dipped into those from time to time. This year with the commemoration of 10 years since the marathon bombings, there are additional commemorations and a memorial finish line that will be unveiled alongside the survivor community. And so we're doing our best to make sure that we are looking back at what happened, spending that time with families who have been forever impacted. And also, you know, according to the consultations and wishes of the survivor community as well, making sure that we're not staying stuck in the past, but using those eyes to look forward to the future.
And just a note for listeners, we here at WBUR will both bring you coverage remembering 10 years since the Boston Marathon and then live coverage of the marathon itself on Patriots Day. There's so much else to cover. I want to move to the MBTA. And of course, today, Governor Mara Healey announces that Philip Eng, who's the former president of the Long Island Railroad, the commuter system for Long Island, is the new MBTA general manager. I just want to start with your reactions.
I'm so excited. We've been ready for this moment. You know, it has felt, I've been riding the T for a long time, since my college days, right, to get over to the marathon to run that faux finish. And before then, it has been a really big part of my life. And so many have commented how it really feels like things have frayed to a point where everybody is just so discouraged and demoralized. We need the leadership at this moment. And Mr. Eng looks like, from his professional experience, from the approach that he has to the work, from the many decades that he has served in systems just like this or even bigger, I'm really thrilled. And we're ready to partner from the city side wherever we can, because this is a moment where we need to go all in and turn things around.
So you, the city, you represent, let me put it that way, you represent a key constituency for the MBTA. Did you have any advanced heads up on this hire, any consultation from the governor's office or the search committee as they narrowed in on a new general manager?
We did hear last night that the appointment was set and ready to be publicly announced. My team and I have been very grateful and thankful to the governor and her administration for keeping us updated and checking in with us along the way about what the city's priorities would be. And we've said from the beginning, we're here to do whatever we can. There are a lot of ways in which the city's jurisdiction over roadways or traffic signals has a lot to do with how effectively the MBTA can operate within the footprint of our municipality. And so we've been eager to push for someone who can hit the ground running, and can't wait to meet Mr. Eng and get to it.
So you and I both got added last night on Twitter from @PKentMA, who said, "At Wu Train, if you're taking the orange line tomorrow to get to your interview with @TCianaDeering, you may want to leave this evening. Been 4 minutes till the next #OakGrove train at Mass Ave for the past 10 minutes. This strikes me in that last week when we had Governor Mara Healey on, we actually had somebody in our texting group text, "I am writing this from a red line train where I'm basically going to be late," and pushing the governor to try to ride a train during rush hour when she had to be somewhere at a certain time. You famously commute. It is getting harder for predictability. Is it affecting you as a rider to be that? I mean, you really need to be places on time.
So I take the T, I don't know, maybe once a week, a couple times a month at least. And I have had to make real decisions about when I know I cannot be late somewhere, that factors in. What time I get on, right? Do I try to see if it's for something that's a little bit past rush hour just so that we're not sitting there for a long time? And so my experiences have been fairly smooth, I would say, just because we're able to choose a little bit more and have that luxury of I can go on the orange line, you know, around 9 a.m. as opposed to 8 a.m. if I'm getting in that day. And the new trains on the orange line, in fact, my chunk of the commute has been one of the places, if you look on the map, where there's a slow zone or two, but it improved a lot. And so there are many, many other parts of the map.
Improved
the red line.
After the massive orange line shut down last fall. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes. And you can feel it. I remember what it was like before then. But particularly for red line riders, particularly for some of the, you know, in that experience that you just mentioned, riders are not demanding perfection, but we need to see a sense of forward movement. We need to see progress, and we need to have that semblance of predictability. It is worse to have a clock that tells you when the next train is coming be wrong than to have no clock at all.
All right, so a couple of more things on transit, but I want to kind of widen our lens from the MBTA and trains exclusively. It's been a year since you made bus routes 23, 28, 29 free. You talked a little bit about last time you were with us about the data that was coming out. We now know that about 40% of people using those free bus services are saving money. Do these findings line up with your expectations for the program? Higher, lower, about equal? And to explain for listeners, the reason the number is 40% while the buses are free is because that may not be the only piece of transit a person is taking on a trip. So there's a transfer fee if you're also on a train, et cetera.
That's right. And I think our goal was to understand how much ridership might grow or be affected with financial barriers removed. And that is pretty significant movement to see these three routes represent the greatest jump in return to pre-pandemic ridership levels across the entire system is not a coincidence. And sometimes it is those riders, you know, it may not be people who are taking the bus to another connection to go all the way down an additional subway line who are saving money, but those residents along that route, the student who lives in Mattapan who needs to get back and forth from RCC Roxbury Community College and previously had been rationing their trips and now can stop along the way, stop at the grocery store, get back on the bus, drop off a kid at childcare, get back on the bus. Those are the life moments that transit is supposed to make easy and seamless. And so we have seen and heard that feedback from residents that it makes a big difference. The ease of not having to worry about the financial stress of it, and if that has an additional factor in decision-making, makes a big difference. We want to continue growing this, ideally in partnership with other municipalities as well, right? Boston is, we make up the lion's share, the majority of the MBTA inner rail subway footprint and bus footprint, but there are some key bus routes that actually cross city lines, and we are hoping that we can establish how a partnership like that would in fact show connectivity between different municipalities and therefore different economic centers or locations that would be a benefit as well.
So then I'm paying attention to the fact that Governor Healey is also looking into reduced fare of free transit for low-income riders. There's a $5 million line item in Healey's proposed 2024 fiscal year budget. But here is my question. If it winds up at reduced fare, should that happen, does that supplant free buses, right? Is this something that is a good both and, or do we run the risk or that one supplants the other in terms of funding and political will? Do you understand my question?
It doesn't have to be and shouldn't be either or. I have been a longtime supporter of reduced fares for residents who are receiving benefits and who are living with lower incomes. Several years ago, this passed through the legislature, and in fact was vetoed by then Governor Baker. And so this has been a long time push that I'm really grateful and excited to see moving forward. I think in some ways, the most immediate vision of what is that combination of reliability, affordability, and growth in our transit system would be reduced fares for low-income riders across the entire system, fare-free bus which often serves more of our low-income residents and residents of color and in key economic corridors. And that combination will help us get further along the pathway to really seeing transit as a public good.
Is this the time? Does it happen this time around?
I hope this is the time. I'm always ready for this to be the time.
I know you want it to be the time, but is it the time?
This is past the time, to be honest. I mean, we are, as many cities elsewhere, trying to reestablish our footing after the pandemic. We are a city that has everything going for us in the type of work environment that companies are looking for, that resident, the type of job opportunities that could be open to residents. We have two issues that we need to fix right away that are the barriers. It's housing prices and it's transit reliability.
Still with us here in Studio 2, Boston Mayor Michelle Wu. I understand you're making an announcement today, although I guess if I ask you about it here on the show, it kind of means you're announcing it right now.
Well, let's do it.
So you are announcing a $750,000 injection into the efforts to create more diversity in city contracting. It's a contracting opportunity fund. Tell us about what the money is for and how it will be used.
This is such low-hanging fruit. If you think about how to most quickly close gaps in the city, create jobs, support our local economy, it is through the many hundreds of millions of dollars that are being put out in contracts that the city of Boston as a market participant is contracting with. And that's everything from the office supplies that are used in City Hall and other city buildings to the contracts to plow snow around community centers and libraries or clear the steps in our facilities. And so we, over many years, have not had a great track record of putting that nearly $770 million of value back into our communities. It makes a difference right away. And so our big focus has been, how do we not only declare that we are going to encourage and even give preference to local, minority-owned, women-owned businesses, but also support businesses with what it takes, the technical assistance to understand how this contracting process works and actually break in. And so this amount is meant to help facilitate breaking down barriers in that front. We know it makes, right away creates jobs in our communities. Take the Boston Public Schools lunch contract, meals contract, for example, shifting that to a locally owned business in just a matter of weeks meant creating 70 plus new jobs. So that you saw all of a sudden saw Boston Public School parents creating the meals that their children would be eating in school. And that's been a huge benefit for nutrition, for health, for our local economy as well.
All right. So I want to move on now. We reached out to our listeners who are in our texting group to send in their questions. And again, to join our texting group, you send the word Boston to 617-766-0382. That's 617-766-0382. Elizabeth of Roslindale said, as a resident of the city of Boston, I'm grateful that she is holding strong on ending arbitration in the police union contract. Residents should feel safe knowing that corrupt and abusive cops can be fired and not returned to the department. Now, I'm going to break this out into two pieces. One is you made the announcement about really pushing back on arbitration in the new police union contract after the firing of at least three Boston police officers. We're going to talk about that firing itself in a minute. For now, we have talked with you in the past about the sticking points in a new contract with the Boston Police. Where are we on that? And is arbitration a sticking point now?
There are, for me, this is not a new conversation, even in the course of putting forward the vision and the reason why I was running for this office. We had a very detailed document laid out then, our plan to tackle contracting as a way to reach reforms. And this was a part of it, that there are certain categories of misconduct or behavior that should not then be relitigated over and over again when it comes to termination.
Relitigated meaning we can appeal it through arbitration and maybe have it.
That's
reversed.
Right. And usually that would end up being a multi-year process and one that is a little bit distanced from the facts of what happened and the rules of the department. And so that is a matter that is up for discussion. We continue to work in the contract negotiation process and We're continuing to hold firm on that.
So we're aware of three recent firings from the Boston Police Department, including two of them being Example Sergeant Shayna Catone and Officer Joseph Abbasciano. Catone for a series of actions against vaccine mandates and masking, including protesting at your house. Abbasciano attended the rally associated with the attempted insurrection on January 6th and put out inflammatory tweets along with that, including accusing the sitting vice president at the time of treason. Now, much more complicated than what I've just laid out there. I have a series of sort of rapid fire questions for you. Is the three of them, is that all? Or were there more firings?
About these types of incidents?
Yes.
That has been related to these sets of incidents.
Okay. What is the status of their desire to appeal for arbitration?
I don't believe that we've received the formal paperwork yet, but through the coverage that I've read alongside everyone else, it sounds that they're hoping to try that.
But you haven't received any formal request for arbitration?
I have not been notified, but I could be wrong.
All right. And now let's step back and let me ask you to explain for our listeners. I know you know that there will be those who will say, well, this was a matter of free speech, right, in both cases. And I know that listeners who want to dive deep into this can read detailed reports now that are available in the media about all of the steps that these officers took that led to their firing. What I want to ask you is, as mayor of the city, what's the thing that crosses the line between free speech and you can no longer effectively do your duty as a Boston police officer?
I think it's important to start with just how serious and weighty the job of being a police officer is in our society. You are called to respond in moments of intense crisis when no one else will take that risk. You are put in situations of quick response, of drawing on all of your training in very dangerous situations to make a call. And because of that serious responsibility and the need for those to protect and serve in our communities, you are given extraordinary tools and authorities to carry that out. Use of force, including with weapons that could end someone's life, the ability to take away someone's freedom and start them through the criminal legal system. These all require a very, very high standard. If we are asking officers to do the important and hard work of enforcing the laws and being the people who will make that call in moments of great intensity, they cannot be above the law themselves. They have to, at a very minimum level, at the very baseline, follow rules, laws at the city, state, federal level themselves. And so when there has been documentation of multiple violations and either unwillingness or inability to follow those rules, that is not someone that we can trust to enforce the rules in, again, very serious situations with serious consequences on our residents.
All right, so I'm going to move us forward. We're talking with Boston Mayor Michelle Wu here in Studio 2. You made reference earlier in our conversation to kind of the big two on the policy front, housing and transit right now. We were talking extensively about transit. I want to move to housing. It does seem that we are at a moment where there is a shared political understanding across the Commonwealth that these are the big two. That doesn't mean there aren't some other big ones like jobs and inflation and those kinds of
climate
things.
Climate and schools.
Right, right. But these are sort of have a pretty significant thud factor in public policy for Massachusetts. But it doesn't mean that everybody agrees on how to handle them. And we've talked extensively about that. I have rent control in mind as I'm thinking about that. To remind listeners, Boston City Council voted 11-2 in favor of your home rule petition to bring rent control, you call it rent stabilization, to Boston. It includes tying the annual rent increases to the consumer price index plus 6%, but capping it at 10%, meaning rents couldn't go above 10%. And it attempts to exempt some owner-occupied properties, 6 units or fewer. There are some other things in there. All right, first, my understanding is you have also signed that. It has gone to the legislature. Have you spoken with either the Speaker of the House or the Senate President directly about this home rule petition?
I have not had the chance since it was formally refiled to connect with them, but I have sat with each of them and other leaders at the state level over many weeks and months to talk about the city's priorities. And they and all of our colleagues at the state share an urgency and understanding that the housing crisis is quite intense, not just in the city of Boston, but all across the Commonwealth.
All right. So now you may be aware that longtime political reporter Mike Dean, who now writes for Axios, has said that House Speaker Ron Mariano, I think it would be gentle to say, has expressed skepticism about the plan, that Senate President Karen Spilka hasn't said anything on the proposal publicly either way. In Dean's article, he essentially suggests it's kind of dead in the water without enthusiastic response from those two leaders. You've said in the past, listen, we just have to do this. It is possible the legislature will not be on board. What happens? And what leverage do you think you have to put the legislature on board if they don't want to?
With our housing crisis as widespread and as painful as it is now, we have to take action. And from the city of Boston's perspective, our approach is always going to be that we will take every possible step. And you don't have to agree with the details, or you may not think that this move or that move is aligned with any particular ideology or vision. But taken together, we need an all-hands-on-deck approach to housing and bringing prices down. If other people have a better solution, put it forward. I am eager and ready to talk about and analyze and partner on anything else. But it cannot be a this or nothing. Let's talk about this or something else, right? This or your solution. Our residents can't afford for nothing to happen.
So can you, and how does it work for you to be, so this is, right, this is the thing. And I'll tell you, Mayor Wu, I'm thinking about this across transit. I'm thinking about it across opioid addiction, mental health care. We tend to have regional or statewide problems, but people who control local or distinct levers. Is there something different than historically we've seen that you can do as mayor of Boston to be in collaboration with members of the legislature, which are tend to operate relatively slowly, and yes, I am saying that, and with a great deal of autonomy? How do you do that? Is there something different to do here?
Well, the beauty of our system is that each level of government has a slightly different setup on purpose, right? By design. At the city level, we are always in the midst of the fire, right? We are always there to deliver the immediate short-term need, to address short-term needs of residents and try to find space to think about the long-term wherever we can. But it is very much, we are that first line of defense, and we need to be directly responsive to the urgency that we hear in our communities. The state is set up so that they're a little bit more of a deliberative body. Their cycles are 2-year legislative sessions versus annually at the city level, and they are looking at a much wider purview. I've actually really enjoyed and appreciated a great working relationship with the state. I think we have gotten to know each other in ways that are deeper and maybe more directly respectful than in the past. And part of that on our end has been really focusing on what we need, as opposed to using the state as a platform where you assume nothing's going to happen, therefore just signal that you care about 70, 80 different things by signing on to all these pieces of legislation. We submitted 7 pieces up that are very focused and that are specifically about challenges in Boston. Many of them are home rule petitions that would only apply to the city of Boston. And that is a range of issues related to housing, transportation, climate, childcare, et cetera. It's not everything in a single bucket, but these are meant to say we're being very clear with what the solutions are that we see. If you want to talk about it, if you want to engage, by all means, let's engage in that process. But we cannot afford to sit back and do nothing. And that's why we're trying to bring as much clarity as possible to these very urgent issues.
So I'm pushing you hard on this, and I want to acknowledge it because you're staying with me, and I appreciate that. Do you believe that you can get your home rule petition passed?
If you ask residents what is most on their minds, the price of housing is the biggest stressor across every demographic, across every part of our city. And so we need solutions there, whether it is rent stabilization, which could happen through legislation, could happen through a ballot initiative, right? There, the advocacy community is talking about a whole lot of steps to keep this momentum going, whether it's a transfer fee that would provide sustainable revenues for us to generate more affordable housing even after the federal recovery funds dry up in the next 2 years or so, or whether it is other innovations in how we can administer our zoning code or find other sources to partner across municipal lines. We are open to any and all of it, and we are just feeling so much the pain of residents. I mean, we even had coverage over the weekend that, in fact, this particular rent stabilization proposal is not threatening to the vast majority of landlords. We are just trying to stop
in the Boston Globe
the worst problem, which is that there are certain places where rent is very unaffordably an extreme increase that happens with no notice to the residents are not able to plan for that. And so, and are immediately getting displaced. We need to stop the 20%, 30%, 50% rent increases that are happening. If you want to stand on the side of being able to implement 50%, 40% rent increases on residents, I just don't hear that argument from anyone. It is much more about, oh, we have fear of what this may lead to, or we don't believe that this is what you actually intend to do. There's a reason why we were specific in putting this proposal forward. Many home rule petitions, because it requires such an elaborate, long process, ask for a range or ask for more flexibility so you don't have to go back. We chose to be completely precise about what
in
we were asking
to
for.
To avoid the concerns about slippery slope is what you're
That's
saying.
That's right.
All right. All right. So listen, on the last subject, but we're here with Boston Mayor Michelle Wu covering a series of just heavy and big policy issues today. A constellation of news in education. So I'm going to ask you just a couple of overarching questions. So, you know, we talked with you about the bus contract last time you were on. That bus contract with TransDev has now been signed. There's a new and significantly larger budget for the Boston Public Schools. News from the Boston Globe over the weekend about college attendance rates and graduation rates for Boston Public Schools students not being where they were after a positive trend of a number of years. Here is my question to you. You're always watching the schools. We talk about the schools often. In this moment, your imaginary dashboard, what is the number one thing you are watching and paying attention to when it comes to the Boston Public Schools?
One thing. There's a couple. So my big picture dream and in the long run where I hope to see us go is to think about enrollment as a factor that we can actually do much more about than we've given ourselves credit for in the past, right? Yes, trends across the country are
K through 12 enrollment?
That's right. Enrollment in the Boston Public Schools. And we have seen, you know, birth rates are down. People are having fewer children. There are, you know, fewer kids in general in most cities. But the drops that we have experienced in Boston, we need to be fighting for every family to feel confident and excited and welcomed in the Boston Public Schools. We know it makes a difference when we put in the work to create a quality experience. The level of uptake or registrations from families who are given a slot, who have the chance to participate in pre-K through the BPS partnerships that we've set up, it is a huge next step where people then sign on to say, actually, I've had a great time, a great experience, and I'm going to then vouch for this system by registering for kindergarten and beyond. We see those drop-offs, and over the years, it has been concerns around high school options. And if you don't get into an exam school, Are there really quality options? That is something that we are laser focused on. And then early on, how do we have enough seats so that families don't get that rejection notice and feel like they literally lost the lottery when we know how many kids are being born in Boston and we should have the resources to do that. So that's why we're making a big move to expand UPK, Universal Pre-K as well.
To private home care providers even.
That's right. And then in the middle, I think another factor, again, this can sometimes be seen as quote-unquote less serious or less connected to the direct substance of academics. But I really believe that having the whole experience of a building, a school building that is state-of-the-art, healthy, updated, and having the programming within that building, youth sports, arts, that will make a big difference. And we're going all in on creating that whole child experience for our students.
All right. I think we are pretty much out of time with Boston Mayor Michelle Wu. I'm just going to ask you, you didn't have Florida Atlantic University in the Final Four for your March Madness, did you? Anybody you picked still left?
I mean, UConn's a sort of, reliable, steady choice year after year, but we'll see what happens.
But for the most part, no.
No.
All right. Boston Mayor Michelle Wu joining us for our monthly Monday with the Mayor. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR. I'm Tisiana Deering. On behalf of the whole team, thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.